The following lecture was delivered at the 11th Annual National Jewish Retreat in Palm Desert, California, a project of the Rohr Jewish Learning Institute. We hope you enjoy the lecture and encourage you to visit jretreat.com for information on upcoming retreats. Rabbi Aaron Rakefeth Rothkopf will now present a lecture entitled, How Israel Raises a Multicultural Army.
I want to thank those of you who have come. Welcome, Shem Makir Molto. Here I'm not in my home territory, so you're looking at what may be a stranger, but I hope within the hour we won't be strangers anymore. In 1969, we went on Aliyah, and the army didn't touch Americans at that time. The State Department objected, and as you recall, in 69, the army was 6'7" tall. Dayan was indestructible. We thought that it was the most powerful army in the world. Along came 73, and until today, we don't know how we survived. I can go into details, but it's not for now. At that point, the army took everyone standing upright, and I wound up doing basic training at the age of 38 in 1976. That's when they had enough people my age to, you have to have a unit that's within, it's a 5-year gap. They can't put you with younger people. They have to have people well into their 30s, and it took until 38, until 76, until this group was gathered together. And we did basic training. I was introduced to the Israeli army with all that that implies. I later served in the reserves till I was 49, and I was kicked out, and I appealed, and they took me back in till I was 54. Then I was kicked out, and the computer kicked me out, so nothing helped, no appeals helped, and I was out. But those were very memorable years in the army, and it got me a chance to really understand the heart of Israel. Now, going back in time, about 120, 130 years ago, the settlers in Palestine had to defend themselves. As you know, the Arabs don't want us there, period. It has nothing to do with Yehuda and Shomron. It has to do that we don't belong there. This is their land, and God gave it to them, and we are usurping them, and we do not belong there. So we used to have what was called originally by the Aramaic word, notrim. Notrim later turns into the Hebrew word shomrim, which means people who would watch over you, who would defend the land. Originally, when you were a shomer, when you were a noter, you ate at home, you slept at home, you went back to home. If your home was kosher, it was kosher. No one interfered with you. Shabbat was Shabbat. No one interfered with you. Then the Palmach begins. The Palmach already in the late 20s is a striking force. Palmach comes from the word in Hebrew is plugat mochets, a striking force. And they fight away from home. And now for the first time, at that time in particular, I would venture a guess that 80% of the country was irreligious. Chiloniyim, as we say in modern Hebrew. Chabad would never agree to that word. The Rebbe never agreed to that word. He wouldn't accept Chiloni. How can you say that about a Jew? He does mitzvah. His very living in Israel is a mitzvah. But for the first time, you have soldiers away from home. You're running a kitchen. To some people, kashrut is important. To other people, they could roast pig with milk and put it into the freezer and eat it on Yom Kippur. So it's a real problem. What do you do when various Jews come together? Shabbat becomes a problem. Even if you have a kosher kitchen, but people who don't observe Shabbat want to cook. They want hot food. They're not just interested in shalent. They want a scrambled egg for breakfast. They want a suda of breakfast like we had this morning. Some of it you have to cook. What do you do? So the Palmach took the easy way out. And they developed two different units in the big cities where there were lots of religious Jews, like Yerushalayim, Petach Tikva, Bnei Brak, Tel Aviv at the time. You had plugat datiyot, plugot that were, everyone was religious. And Shabbat, Kashrut, everything was observed. And then you had the general army, the general palmach, where you could do whatever you want. Ish hayashah be'enav yaseh. Each one could do what he wants. I had had the privilege to stand around the corner from my house on Rehov Azam with the commander of the Jerusalem religious division of the palmach. He was a full colonel, Avraham Melamed, Zichrono Levracha. And we became very friendly because he was an administrator in chinuch, in education, and I was teaching. We became very friendly. And he showed me the building right around the corner from me where Shlomo Legorenchik was a sharpshooter as part of the religious unit of the Palmach in Yerushalayim. Can anyone tell me who Reb Shlomo Legorenchik later becomes? That's Rav Shlomo Gorin, general, chief rabbi, etc. His original name was Gorenchik. So that was the religious unit. Something happened in 47 which had great implications. You can read about this in the history books about the army. From Syria, they were smuggling arms into Lebanon, into Israel. And Ben-Gurion, at the advice of the commanders of the Palmach, the upper echelon of command, reached the conclusion, if they don't wipe out this smuggling route, they're not going to win the war in the Galil. In order to wipe out the smuggling route, they would have to smuggle soldiers into Syria, up north. They could do that. They would blow up the bridge that these arms were coming across. But the minute they blow up the bridge, they'll be discovered, and there's no way to bring them back to Israel. So Ben-Gurion finally said, send in the religious unit from Bnei Brak, Petach Tikva, and I'm quoting what they claim were his words, maybe their God will save them. When that happened, close to 20 young men were wiped out. The old-timers in Bnei Brak told me that there used to be a day that everyone said Kaddish because everyone, there were so many families related to these youngsters. The Chazon Ish, who was the leading religious authority in Israel, of Avraham Yeshaya Karelitz of Vilna and then of Bnei Brak, the Chazon Ish was hysterical, and he gave an order, break up the religious units, because if they're going to think like that, maybe their God will save them, there will not be a religious soldier left alive. Within a year, it was no longer a theoretical problem. All of you know the State of Israel was formed, and the first law passed by the State of Israel was creating the Israeli Defense Force. All private armies threw in their arms. That means there was Eitzel, there was Lehi. All the other armies joined together with the Palmach, and we now have the IDF. Now, the army faced this tremendous dilemma. Do we follow the Palmach, or do we have one army? And here, I have to tell you, when David Ben-Gurion, the 100th anniversary of his birth, there were endless TV programs, radio articles in Israel, scholars fighting back and forth. Why did Ben-Gurion give in so much to the religious Jews? And the State of Israel, I don't have to tell you, until today, the most important laws are in the hands of the rabbinate, the laws of divorce and marriage, which literally save us as one people. We don't have mamzeret, we don't have civil marriage in Israel. It enables us to remain one people. Conversion is in the hands of the rabbinate, etc. So there were two theories. One theory is Ben-Gurion gave in because the way he was raised, he still remembered his parents, his grandparents, the Yiddishkeit of Eastern Europe. Another theory, which is probably more correct, Ben-Gurion figured in 20 years, there won't be a religious Jew left. You got to remember, the Mapai, those creating the state, Golda Meir, Levi Eshkol, that whole group, They believe they're creating a new Jew. We're going to be Zionists. We're going to be Israelis. We're going to be like Americans. We're going to be like English people. All anti-Semitism will disappear. We'll be a nation among the nations. So people argue why he gave in. He got up in the Knesset in 1949, and there was a big debate raging. One army or two armies? One would be kosher, Shabbat, and the big army, the bigger division at that time, would be whatever you want. If you see a rabbit running and you shoot the rabbit, you can roast it in the army kitchen. Ben-Gurion got up and he said in the Knesset, Morai v'Rabotai, we're going to create one army. We can't go on with division. And he described the Chagorat Tzva'it. It's the belt you wear. Every soldier gets a belt. Not a belt like this, an army belt. And he said, you'll hook onto the belt bullets, grenades, a canteen. And for those who want, they can hook on tefillin. And with those words, he created one army. By the law of the land of Israel, every army kitchen has to be kosher. In every army kitchen, there's a sign up, Asur lahadlik esh b'shabbat b'pkuda. And I have to explain that. It's forbidden to light fire in the kitchen to cook. It's a command. Now, what does a command mean? I'll illustrate it very simply. This was a true case that happened in the 80s. You all know feminism, I'll speak about this in one of the sessions. I call it the greatest problem we in the Torah rabbinate face today. Chabad solved the problem. I'm jealous of Chabad on that level, but in the YU world, I get endless questions from my students who are all rabbis all over the world, basically, feminism. By 1980s, feminism was all over already. What reached America in the 60s reached Israel in the 80s. So there was a general in Tel Aviv, and in his office was an officer, was a lieutenant, a captain. She was one of his aide-de-camps. And he asked her to make him a cup of coffee, and she refused. And he filed a complaint to put her on trial for what's called in modern Hebrew, siruv pekuda, refusing a command. And the judges are listening, and the judges differentiated. A command means when you're a soldier, they're commanding me, shoot at that target. Fine. They're commanding me, our last grandson went into the army a week. It was the August 1st draft. He went in a few days before with this, all our grandchildren in the army, and it's quite a number, Baruch Hashem. So a command is you drive a tank. You jump. I have many grandchildren, paratroopers. That's a command. To ask someone to make you a cup of coffee is a request, a bakasha. Now, if this is your boss, it may not be too wise to say to him, I'm not going to make the cup, but it's your decision. I want you to know how they solved the problem. An amicable solution. It made headlines in the Israeli papers. One day he made the coffee, and one day she made the coffee. But you see, that's what a pkuda means. If you light a fire on Shabbos in the kitchen, if you're an officer, you'll go to jail for 7 days. If you're not an officer, they'll fine you a month's salary. It's a pkuda, a command. The problem of cooking in the kitchen is a major problem. So what the army did, they reached a fabulous solution. I'm an eyewitness. I benefited from the solution. All the big kitchens are under hashgacha. Inevitably, the mashkichim, kerech hasidim, belzech hasidim, this is what they do in the army. And these guys, I don't know, I guess it's from being in a kitchen, they're 6'5" and 6'5" white. They're wide. You don't start up with them. Take my word for it. They have what to eat, but you don't start up with them. The big kitchens are under hashgacha. In the outlying kitchens all over, the army has a rule. And remember, they're small bases, 50 soldiers, 20 soldiers, 30 soldiers. The army has a rule. The army never cooks milchiks. All hot food is fleishiks or parava. It is never milchiks. It's important to eat milk. So they give out cheese, they give out yogurt, gil, the Israeli specialties. Eishel, maybe a milky, which was in the news with Berlin. I write about it. I have an article coming out in Jewish Action. The next issue, I have a piece on my Madrichen B'nai Akiva, Meir Kahana. So I write about the milky scandal. Come to Berlin, the milkies are cheaper, if you know what went on in Israel during this past year and a half. That's cold. You can't trafe up the kitchen. You can eat what you want, but you cannot trafe up the kitchen. So this is the way they handled Shabbat and Kashrut. Shabbat in general is not really a major problem. Once the army by law does not allow any training and any drills on Shabbat, then of course what we call in Hebrew, it's an abbreviation, batash, bitachon shel teif, ongoing security. There, it's pikuach nefesh. You have to have the jeeps running on Shabbos, the tanks running, the airplanes flying. This is pikuach nefesh. So there's no argument whatsoever that you're allowed. So the army had to accommodate chiloniyim, datiyim. Today, the country is going into a totally new phase of existence. Ben-Gurion had a dream, as I mentioned 15 minutes ago, that the religious Jew would disappear. What Ben-Gurion didn't realize, and it's actually a letter that Rav Kook wrote to a Rosh Yeshiva about 1908-1909, Rav Avram Yitzchak HaKohen Kook was then chief rabbi of Jaffa, and there was a Rosh Yeshiva whose sons were swept away by, if you know what went on in the early part of the 20th century, socialism, Bundesism, anarchism, ultimately communism. Yeshiva boys came home for Shabbos and never went back to the yeshiva, never put on tefillin again. This was par for the course. You can't not imagine what went on. This is why the fifth Rebbe organized a yeshiva. Whoever heard of a yeshiva in the Hasidic world? Everyone went to the Rebbe's court. But the fifth Rebbe understood with the winds of change, you need an organized yeshiva. You can't allow haphazard, desultory study. And that's the start of Tomchei Tamimim. So Rav Kook wrote to this Rosh Yeshiva, who asked him, should I disown my sons? And he wrote to him, keep up the relationship with your sons. You never know what will happen in the future. They're being misled by the sirens of the time. And he writes about the secular Zionists. Rav Kook writes this. It's prophetic how they have this dream and they think they can do away with religion, and their own grandchildren, if it's Zionism without Torah, will throw away Zionism and ultimately hate the land of Israel. And I need not tell you, lo aleinu, all the founders of the state of Israel, from Ben-Gurion on, and you can go one by one, Dayan and Barak, one by one, all have children living in America, Canada, Germany, South Africa, Australia, and grandchildren totally intermarried. It is so sad. The great-grandparents at least believed in Eretz Yisrael. But if it's not accompanied by Torah Yisrael, then absolutely nothing remains. When Malka and I came in Aliyah some 47 plus years ago, this is my 48th Yomim Neroyim coming up on holy soil. When we went in Aliyah, if you would stand at the center of Jerusalem and watch the people walking by, maybe 1 out of 10 men wore a kippah. Maybe 1 out of 20 women, married women, covered their hair. Today, if you stand in the center of Jerusalem, it is rare to see someone without a kippah or a woman without her hair covered. I get on the light rail and I'm embarrassed. I don't know. I feel that when I'm in the classroom, those of you who'll see me in a few weeks back in behind my desk in Gruss, YU, I have a big room there, a lot of students and many outsiders coming. some of them world famous outsiders. And I feel, I always say when Shia begins, how old is the youngest person sitting here? So we find a kid of 23, 24. I'm 21 today. So I don't feel that at all. I get on the light rail, five Moroccan women who look older than I am jump up to give me a seat. And inevitably, all their heads are covered. And I'm embarrassed. I say, no, ani rak naseyesh dei tachanot. I'm only going to Machne Yehuda. I'm only going two stops. But they insist I have to take the seat. The population of Israel has shifted. Big research was done that caused an explosion. I'm sure you're all familiar with it. It reached the New York Times a few years ago. I believe it came out of Tel Aviv University, their sociological department. Sociologia, it's an anglicized Hebrew word today. So the population of Israel is turning very religious, not just what we call in popular language, kipot srugot, like myself. I'm a man of the world. I have a doctorate. I'm the Talmud of Rav Soloveitchik. I define myself as a Torah Jew who lives in the Western world, okay? I'm not modern Orthodox. I don't like that word. I don't like the word. That's for different lectures, not for now. But I'm already an open person. Today, next year, there are going to be more kids getting what's called in Hebrew charedi education than in the so-called religious Zionist system, which is public education. The population has shifted. There are many reasons why. One of the main reasons is like the United States of America. It took a long time to develop a rabbi in America who could speak the language of the land. Rabbi Eliezeri, my next topic after I finish the Rebbe is the history of the rabbinate in America. Okay, it took a long time. It took a good 100 years. There was no Lubavitch in America. And I got news for you. The way the Rebbe and the previous Rebbe and the present, the seventh Rebbe, started Chabad, it took a while for them to understand what America's about and how to reach out. I'm still inspired. I remember as a kid, the sixth Rebbe, and it may be the seventh Rebbe was really involved, they published comic books for kids. Did you ever see them? Pee Wee Myers, the baseball player. Can anyone tell me why every American kid in Brooklyn went crazy with joy? Who was the big Brooklyn Dodger star? Pee Wee Reese. Pee Wee Myers. No, you got to understand America. In Israel, it took 100 years, 150 years. We're developing a rabbinate that speaks the language of the youth of the land. That's one factor. A second factor. The Zionist dream was so great that I once said, speaking to an audience in Israel, that the classes that graduated, Eitz Chaim was Rabbi Yisrael Zalman Meltzer, was Rosh Yeshiva. This is the heart of the Meir Shearim Geula area. I said, maybe 20% remained from. A man with a long beard and a bekesha jumped up and he, Kvod Harav, Ani Rotzeh Letaken, I want to correct you. He says, I am a graduate of the 1951 Eitz Chaim class. We were 280 children. I'm the only one who remained from. The only one. Once on Erev Rosh Hashanah, I was walking in Gula, and you all know the Gerish Stibble there. And I see the Gerish Stibble. I was in Machon Gold, Stella. I was in Machon Gold for that Shabbos or whatever it was. So I was right near, you know how far we were from Ger, two blocks. And I see army cars driving up one after another, generals getting out. I couldn't believe my eyes. I said, what's going on? What's going on here? They told me they're all generals. We're raised in Gera homes, survivors. Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, they came back to daven by the Rebbe all year. They were Mechalalei Shabbos, who knows what they ate. Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, they were back in the Gera Shtibble. Their kids already knew a lot less. Today, again, we have a problem. I don't want to tell you it's 100% or 90%. You know the problems you have it in Lakewood. It's the Haredi world. We have it in our... And children drop off. There are reasons why. Again, it's not for now. These are all topics that I have what to say, but it's not for now. But 80% at least remain like the parents. Well, do the mathematical progression. You have 8, 9 children. Multiply it by thousands and thousands. 80% remain from, and they have children. Wow. And then, of course, the greatest miracle of all, the kibbutz galyat. We now have in Israel unto 7 million halachic Jews. I spoke the night that we hit 6 million a few years ago in Yom HaTzmut. Everyone was in tears because 6 million is very significant for us. Very significant number. Where do we get them from? The best of America. My grandchildren are very angry at Malka and myself why we leave Israel and go to America, go to South Africa, go to Australia, go to Canada. What are you wasting your time? But we tell them, I know you're angry at the Jews who are not joining us yet, but America gives its Trumat Maisrat, the finest of you come in Aliyah. What Nefesh B'Nefesh does, and these are all people I know, and I'm willing to bet that more than half the people who have come in Aliyah, they just celebrated 50,000 Nefesh B'Nefesh people, Olim, are more than half are my students or friends of students, people I've had some impact on. France, who would ever dream what's happening in France? They look at the French and say, are you crazy to remain here? Jewish life is valueless in France. The Arabs, it's God's revenge against Europe, what they did to the Jews. The Arabs will absolutely take over France if they haven't already. It's a democracy, Western world, Obama, all that goes with it. Just think what's happening. Israel, in my neighborhood, my wife is walking on the street and she hears two French ladies speaking together. And my wife knows French, and this lady is boasting she lives on Rue Rav Berlin. Rue, not Rehov, Rav Berlin. Oh, what a street. My neighborhood, I live in one room with 3 closets for bedrooms. I'm not going to tell you what my apartment is worth, but I can buy a villa, a mansion in Lawrence for what my apartment is worth due to location. We bought it in 69 next to nothing. Why? Because there's a big shul 2 blocks away, Ohel Nechama. Ohel Nechama was built by Germans, a German community that wanted to expiate their sins, and they gave the money to build the shul. It is Nusach Alsace-Lorraine. Every Frenchman wants to be an Ashkenazi Frenchman. The Sfardim all want to be on the Riviera. They go to Netanya, they go to Herzliya, they go to Ranana. In my neighborhood, I walk Shabbos to my daughter. That's from Rehavia to the start of Katamon. You hear more French on the street than English. I told my students in Rehavia Katamon, anyone over 21 years of age speaking Hebrew is arrested for desecration of airspace. Anyone over 21, all they speak is French, English, you hear a little Russian. It's unbelievable. Menhet noch a bissel Yiddish. It's unbelievable. The joke going around is, when do a French Ole and an American Ole speak Hebrew? When they have to speak to each other. Then they have to speak a broken Hebrew to each other. Now, this Aliyah, you understand, has affected the entire face of the country. And even the Russian Aliyah, which came with the leftist rejoicing, we're going to be a majority again. Who would ever dream how right-wing they are? And they took over the country. There's never been a more successful Aliyah than the Russian Aliyah. Rabbi Le'ezri's boss is Natan Sharansky. But more than that, he's a Shomer Shabbos. The head of the Knesset, Yuli Edelstein. Malka and I brought him, smuggled in money and food when he was running away in jail. Who would ever dream he would be running the country, the third most important individual in the state of Israel? President, prime minister, chairman of the Knesset, Mitak Ayamakran has said. Who would ever believe the head of the coalition, Levin, with the yarmulke on. And these are all Russians going to any hospital. Russians, Russians, Russians. This has affected the army. And something has happened today. It's a confluence of two happenings. One happening is, and by the way, Chabad is right in the middle of all this right now, if you're up to date on what's going on in Kfar Chabad and in Israel. One river, one storm coming along, the population is changing. 50 to 60% of the officers' training courses keep put on the head. They're now brigadier generals. They were major generals, but now a whole cadre, a whole group of brigadier generals, big kippot in their heads. Some of them you know. Tatalov, Brigadier General Mordechai Kahana, that's Meir Kahana's nephew. Tatalov Hoshea Friedman, he's a future Hasidic Rebbe, he's the son of Rabbi Israel Friedman, it's from the Rishnissa dynasty, it's a big shtibble in Gilo. Eshtei Dibet the Tata, he stands over his father with tzitzis out, with a big beard, Peayir Tzadik with a Rush and a Shtreimel, if you know it's different than a Belzer or a Gera, or an old Yerushalmi Shtreimel, or a Chabad Rebbe Bala Shtreimel, he may have known what he was doing, at least not to kill animals, but I think there were deeper reasons. He's the next Rebbe. Do you know what uniform he's wearing? Not a Bekesha, not black. He's in the uniform of the Israeli Defense Forces, a brigadier general with tremendous responsibility. He's the head of the whole Miluim system, of the whole reserve unit. He's the man that has to mobilize the army and see that it mobilizes properly. So that's one part of what's happening today. The other part is the Haredi world is changing. Haredim today are no longer afraid. Again, I'm speaking the majority. There's always going to be, till Mashiach comes, my Rebbe always used to say, Rav Soloveitchik, when I say my Rebbe, not the Rebbe, but Rebbe with an I. My Talmidim call me Rebbe. I won't let them call me Rabbi because the title Rabbi today has been compromised by certain scandals. It hurts. So I tell my Talmidim, it's Rebbe with an I, my teacher, my Rav. Or if I never taught you Torah, it's Aaron, Ani, Aaron, whatever name you know me by. So my Rebbe is Rav Soloveitchik, Moriu Rebbe. So Rav Soloveitchik always used to say, the prophet speaks about Kol Banayach Limudei Hashem, all your children will be learned of Torah. He used to say, Tul Yimot HaMashiach, it'll be Rov Banayach, the majority of your children. There's always going to be an extreme right-wing lunatic fringe. You can't get upset about it. I tell my children, they see the Neturah Kata demonstrating Michal Shabbos, demonstrating against Israel. So I tell them, don't get excited. This is a lunatic fringe. But the heart and soul of the Haredi world today, look, we don't want to be poor anymore. We want to earn a living. There's nothing wrong with going into the public thoroughfare. Half the leaders of the country have kippot. A third of them have beards already. The State Attorney General, Mandelblit, the big black kippahs, kids go to Haida in Bnei Brak. So the kids say, if he can do it, we can do it. I daven mincha at least once a week in Machon Lev when I give shir in the kollel on Sunday afternoons. I catch mincha in Machon Lev, which is the neighboring campus. You've heard of Machon Lev, right? I don't have to explain it. Machon Lev, it began in 68. It's a really modeled after Yeshiva University. They learn until one, and afterwards they have endless courses in science, in mathematics, in high tech, in nursing. They have a branch for women. What Israel needs. They don't go into the humanities like YU because they had to get Rav Shach's approval, and he wouldn't allow any humanities, any literature. But you come into Machon Lev, tens of thousands of students, thousands of Haredim. The head of the computer department is my own student, got smicha from YU. He discovered his roots. He's a slonim achasid, geitmet alanga bekesha, the hat, the works. Endless students, every type of kippah, every type of bekesha. And they all serve in the army. The army today not only has to accommodate when you have the religious Zionist and the general Zionist. I don't like the word secular Zionist. I agree, and who am I to agree with the Rebbe? But there the Rebbe hit the nail on the head, and Haredim as well. Now here there's a real problem, because what do you do with the kitchen? Haredim, you know, in Israel, any product that wants to sell has a double heksha. By law, you have to have the local rabbinate. Once you have, and this was just upheld by the Supreme Court, once you have the local rabbinate, so people will come along, this is a Zionist rabbi, you can't depend upon him. You know my vata with Baal Tshuva, and I saw it with my own eyes. You make a kid frum, and the kid comes from a treif home, and 3 years later, he's not eating in your house because you don't have the right hechsherim. So they have to have a second heksher. So you have a second heksher, you're all familiar, the Eder Haredit, Magzike Hadat of Bells, Sheirut Yisrael of Panovich. You all have a second heksher in Israel. Fine. In America, too, I see every product has an OU, and if they're selling in Borough Park and Flatbush, they have to have a second heksher as well. A Rebisha Hashkacha. You should know the OU is probably the most reliable Hashkacha in the world. I know how it works. I know the inner workings. I know the computerization. I know the people involved. You can eat the OU off the floor. But all right, others don't use regular milk. Chabadnik can only eat Chalav Yisrael. So there already he needs more than the OU, because OUD means it's regular milk. Only if it says Chalav Yisrael is it good for Chabadnik. So what do you do in the army? So here what's happening, you now have separate units, but it's part of the overall army. It's integrated, but the kitchens are separate. For instance, all the meat is glut. The Chal of Yisrael in Israel is not a problem, but they're very medaktik. It's not just Chal of Yisrael, but never a problem with Shabbos, milking the cows on Shabbos by the machines where there's a machlekes hapaiskim. So these come from weekday milkings that have nothing to do with Shabbos. All the products have to meet the glut standard. So they have a kitchen. And you now have not just Nachal Haredi, you have already a Hezder Haredi, headed up by a student of mine. It began in Machon Lev. It functions out of Petah Tikva. Rabbi Gross. It's one of Alexander Gross's sons, Kami Gross. He heads up the Nachal, the Hezder Haredi. You now have in Givati, Golani, you have Tzanchanim, a whole unit of Tzanchanim Haredim. And here you have some beautiful, beautiful stories. When Nachal Haredi began, one of the first soldiers wrote a memoir. It was a bestseller in Israel. So I'll tell you a light story and a very moving story. The light story is very simple. Suddenly, on the base of Nachal Haredi, there's a shutdown. So no one knew what was happening. They were worried. Terrorists are on the loose. The total shutdown. Remain in your bunks. Don't budge. Everyone was frightened. What's happening? It turned out a female soldier walked onto the base by mistake. And in that base, you could not have female soldiers. And that's what the shutdown was. Not a terrorist, not an Arab. It was simply a lady entered the base. That's the story he tells. The end of the book is very emotional because this person grew up in a Briska home. He had a break with his family, his parents. He had a Haredi education. Some of you know Haredi education. They realized the problem in Israel today, I don't know about America, that you can't teach everyone the same way. Not everyone is made the same. In Israel, I tell everyone, my youngest grandson who just entered Hezda, he's in a Hezda of Rabbi Adin Steinsaltz. What is unique about this Hezda? My grandson is a saxophonist. From 1 to 3, the bass, the Hezda, becomes a Philharmonic Orchestra. Every kid in that Hezda has to play a musical instrument. Thank you. Every kid has to play a musical instrument. The moving story is this young man from the first Hezda. He today is a reporter. He writes. He's very well known at Talmud Chacham. Had a break with his family. Went through hell. His father sat shiva for him. A terrible story. But he always didn't get along. He tells the story how he went to the zoo with the chayda, with the cheda. And in the zoo, everyone else looked at the animals. He asked questions. Why does this animal sleep by day, not by night? Why does he hibernate? And the Rebbe slapped him. You don't ask questions. This is the way God made the world. So he broke, and he was wandering along, and an American Rav picked him up in Bayit Vagan and said, look, they're beginning a Nachal Haredi. Why don't you join it? And he became an outstanding soldier and became frum again. And then he had no home to go to for Shabbat. So he would be farmed out. The army has a whole division that takes care, again, a modern Hebrew word, chayalim bodedim. How do you translate it into English? Soldiers who are lone soldiers. They have no family there, no place to go Shabbat when he's off from the army. So families would adopt him. So he was in the big shopping center that opened in Malchutz, the biggest shopping center in the Middle East. I can't go there, it's too crowded. We go to a Hadar in Talpiyot. There it's Menschlich. You can walk through, it's not so noisy. And he buys flowers for Shabbos to bring to the family. On the bus, a young lady starts up with him. Chayal, bishvil mi haparachim elu? Who are these flowers for? And he looks at the young girl, and he gives her the flowers. And the girl says to him, Eifata misharet, where do you serve? He says, Ani b'nachal charedi, I'm in Nachal Charedi. She says, Al tavoldal, I don't, it's the Hebrew, I can't even translate, that's a colloquialism today. Don't work me over. What are you playing games with me? You don't have a beard. Your tzitzis are nuts. I know what charedim are. I came from Charedi. I just finished the army, she says. And you are Nachal Charedi? So he takes out his pinkas, his service card, and shows her. P.S., they're now married many, many years with many, many children. I told the story in England, in Hendon, and the Rebbetzin cut me off and got hysterical and jumped on the table and started dancing. She said, that is my niece. She is the daughter of the chief rabbi of Holland, the Rebbetzin. This was her niece. Her brother, excuse me, was the chief rabbi of Holland. This was her niece. And she broke with the family. She went in Aliyah, served in the army, was a Shomeret Shabbat, but in a different shtans than the way she was raised. And she's the one who married the young man from the first Nachal Charedi. At the end of the book, they asked him, David, with all that you've gone through, to break with your family, to go to the army, to change your lifestyle, was it worth it? And he said, look at my wife, and that's your answer. Beautiful book. Charedim Legoralam is the name of the book. It's a play on words in Hebrew. I don't know of an English translation. Charedim means two things. The colloquial, super religious, let's say, and Charedim, worried, anxious, what will be? And here, Charedim Legoralam, they were worried about their future, what will be. So you see, excuse me? No, I don't know of an English translation. Mal, am I right? There's no English. No. What I'm saying is, I'm trilingual, but all my languages are with a Bronx accent. You have to bear that in mind. So what have I said so far? I'm a Talmud of the Rav, so as my wife says, when you lecture, at least you summarize, we remember something. What have we said so far? It's a real problem, taking together Jews of every stripe and color and forging one army. That we have an army and have a chain of command, it's beyond words. I know in the army, I was makpid when I did basic training. I saluted every officer. Generally, you only salute the top officers. But the law, according to army protocol, if he's got the rank here, you have to salute him. I went out of my way to salute every officer, labriot. And the kashrut, the Shabbat, So we've achieved the modus vivendi in the army. The story with the girl, with the coffee, the difference between kuda and bakasha, fascinating. Today, what's happening, it's the whole population in Israel. These are the big headlines from the Arabs aren't shooting. All the newspapers are concerned with Charedim Olecha Yisrael. The Charedim are taking over. And this has many, many implications, but in order to take over, you have to be prepared to run a country, to know what high technology is about, to have Charedim who are pilots, gunners, sharpshooters, great economists, and all that goes with it. But one picture is worth a thousand words. If you want to see what's happened in the army, and I was sharing this, I'll tell you how. It's a story for a Melamed. Over the generations of teaching, I've had some failures, but I've had a lot of success. Back in 73, I had a student who I knew as a little kid in my first rabbinate. And this kid had no zitzflesh. A great lamdan he will never become. In order to become a lamdan, you have to have the ability to sit and learn. Yom Kippur War came, and he was out in the battlefield. I have a watch, it's okay. 10 minutes, 8 minutes. He was out in the battlefield, and the dean wanted to throw him out. Rabbi Horowitz. So although I wasn't a big shot yet, but I told Reb Moshe, listen to me, don't throw this kid out. Alamdin vetanish sein. He doesn't have zitzflesh, but he's going to be a great klal tour for Israel. He was entertaining the troops with his guitar, like you saw last night, the guitar player. He was down in Egypt, where the Egyptians, remember Kissinger was negotiating, and the Jews and the Egyptians were right next to each other. He was entertaining the troops. Thank God Rabbi Horowitz listened to me. And he today is a lieutenant colonel in the IDF, in charge of relations with the religious diaspora. He brings in Sifrei Torah. He gets people to contribute to portable shuls that he developed. I can show you pictures. It's beyond comprehension what he worked out. You wheel it like a closet. It opens into a shtender, Kriyat HaTorah. There's a Torah inside. There's Sidurim. There's a place for Lulav and Etrog. Kiddush, Havdalah, unbelievable. Rakefet, I'm the one who started this campaign now to build a mikveh for men on every army base. Because if Hasidim are coming into the army, you know my Talmud Hasidim, they go to mikveh every morning. So there was an incident in the big army base, Tzrifin, it's like a city, where the Hasidim were going, waking up at 4:30 instead of 5, and going to the neighboring town to go to the mikveh. So they built the mikveh for men there. For women, there's a tremendous army base down south where you have thousands of women living. It's the Air Force base where you need a crew. To get a plane in the air, you need 100 people within minutes to take care of everything. So they all have to live there. So there's a $100,000 state-of-the-art mikveh for women. I'm talking about for men. So I already got my first pledge to build a mikveh. I have to do it through my Talmud, Jetty Atlas. But what Jetty developed, this came a few years ago, every soldier going into the army could request, when he gets his uniform, he can get 2 pairs of tzitzit. You see how it's army tzitzit? Everyone with me? This wasn't good enough. Soldiers complained, it's an extra garment, you sweat. Jetty developed, and the material is imported from China, special material, like an athlete, no sweat. It's put together in Israel. I'll tell you in a second who puts the tzitzit on. Look at the way it's cut, you see? So you need tzitzit, it's slit into 4 corners. Instead of wearing a shirt, this qualifies as the outer garment. It's like a t-shirt. You put your hands in. Now, do it right already. Okay. Would anyone want to guess who makes the tzitzit? Who puts the tzitzit on? This is hard work. Absolutely. It is
the army
prisoners, Jews that are in prison for Siruf Pekuda, what we spoke about earlier. So they get a month in jail, a week in jail, 3 weeks in jail. He didn't show up after Shabbos. If he can show that he's a Shomer Shabbos and the rabbi of the prison approves him, instead of working on license plates, he works on tzitzit. Okay? So this gives you an idea of what we're talking about and what is happening. And I want to conclude. You spoke about it. You heard the talk last night. I told the young man who spoke that I now know my students are correct, because my students tell me that am I pronouncing it right? Bob Dylan, whatever. There's the Zimmerman, I think I was told, that he has a son-in-law, Shema Shabbos. I don't know who Dylan is. I don't know who the son-in-law is. Last night, at least I learned who the son-in-law is. Himmelman, right? The man who entertained. So he spoke about Hashgacha Pratit. So I have to tell you, I've also seen the hand of God in a tangible fashion many times, and I call it Gilui Eliyahu, the rabbinic aphorism, that it's something is happening. They're speaking to you. So I'll tell you, I'll end off what I'm telling you what happened to me in 1977. When I finished basic training, the State of Israel sent me back to America to address the RCA, the Rabbinical Conference of America, Rabbinical Council of America convention. Then it was still conventions. Today I understand everything is done by internet, interaction. It's a different world, but I'm still part of the old world. Baruch Hashem, I don't regret it. It's life. My great-grandchildren know more about a computer than I do. So not only did I address the RCA convention, but they sent me to some communities. And one of the communities I went to was Detroit. I addressed a big crowd in a suburb of Detroit, a young Israel. I remember Rabbi Jimmy Gordon, if I'm not mistaken, was the rabbi, Zichrono Levracha, a wonderful individual, later came to Yerushalayim. And I spoke about modern-day Israel. That was my mission, my goal. And I told the following story. I said, you know, in Europe, they didn't have rabbis who preached. Today in America, Moshe Rabbeinu couldn't be a rabbi because he stutters. The first thing, when my students try out for a rabbinate, they have to preach a sermon. All right, preaching is an art, but not everyone can do it. But in Europe, they didn't want the rabbi to preach. The rabbi sat and learned and Kapaskin Shilas. They had Magidim, who traveled around. Dubna Magid, they went from community to community, and they preached the sermons. They were experts. Everyone came out to hear them, including the Rabbanim. So one time in Grodno, this goes back 120 years, in Grodno, 115 years, the Magid comes to town, and Reb Shimon Shkup, the Rav of the city, the Rosh Yeshiva of the Grodno Yeshiva at that time, comes to hear him. And the Magid at the end starts maledicting and cursing the Zionist, and he breaks into laughter. I'm living it in Yiddish, but I'll try to say it in English. And the Magid says, the Zionistim, they will name in Palestine, was not in, they will ice climbing an army, they're going to choose an army, they're going to fight the Arabs. What, we Jews can have an army? No, let us see how we make an army. Imagine they're going to renounce all able-bodied Jewish men between the age of 18 to 39, come out to the town center and line up for the army. But it's a Jewish army. Then you have to have a Kohen Mashuach Muhammad, a Kohen appointed to lead them into battle, and the Kohen will say, Mi Hayish Shebana Bayit, who just built the house? No. 10,000 guys walk away, they're exempt, they bought a house, they're getting a house, they're in the middle of a mortgage negotiation. Mi Hayish Ashalakach, he just got married. Who just got married? No, this guy got married the first year. This guy is dreaming of getting married. This guy is engaged. This guy is deciding if he's old enough to get married. Another 20,000 disappear. Then, Miha Yisha Shebana Bayet Lakachisha Natak planted a vineyard, planted a vineyard, planted the fruit, vegetables. He has to see it developed. Chas v'chalil, he should go to war and die and not eat of the fruit of his labors. You're now left with 50,000 out of the initial 100,000. Then the Kohen Mashiach Mocham has to say, Mi ha'ish ha'yarei v'rach ha'levav, who is the person who is frightened of going into battle? And the Gemara in Sota, the Bavli, the Yerushalmi, what do you mean frightened? That he speaks between the Tfilin Shel Yad to the Tfilin Shel Rosh. He interrupts between Yishtabach to Yotze'ah. Ribbono Shel Olam, you're left with four people going into battle. Reb Yitzchak Elchanan Spector, the Netziv of Elazhin, the Gerer Rebbe, and the Lubavitcher Rebbe, and mit zei vel men machen a krieg, and with these four gedolim, we're going to go into battle and fight the Arab hordes. And the place, they say, Reb Shimon Shkop was hysterical with laughter. He had a very good sense of humor. Everyone is laughing. Do you know that at the end of the lecture, they wheel a man in a wheelchair, 102 years old, and he falls over me, and a faint, and he's crying, and he says, wie kann das sein, als ein junger Amerikaner Mensch, kann das sein, als ein Meister, ich hab gewinnt dabei. Und das ist richtig, Reb Shimon, how can it be, a young American person could tell this story, I was there. And Reb Shimon was hysterical with laughter. There's an addendum to the story that later the same Magid went to Brisk and he told the same drasha. And Reb Chaim Brisk, Mori Rebbe's grandfather, Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, was sitting there. And everyone is laughing when he ends. And Reb Chaim says, Was Lachman? What are they laughing about? With Reb Yitzchak Elchanan Spector and the Netziv and the Gerer Rebbe and the Lubavitcher Rebbe can machen a guter Krieg. We will win. We'll make a good war. And I, when the end off, look to what we're privileged from that Russia of the Magid to what we have today, Tzva Haganah LiYisrael. Thank you very, very much.